This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's a complicated world, but the Briefing Room is one place you and I can go to make sense of it. In just under half an hour, with the help of top experts, we can try and get across one of the big issues of the day. This week, what will the NHS look like the other side of the pandemic? It all seems like such a long time ago now.
In Italy, there's been the biggest daily rise in deaths since the beginning of the outbreak there.
Really shocking figures, like Italy is losing the equivalent of a village a day. 919 deaths in the past 24 hours.
Back in early March, we watched as parts of the Italian health system more or less collapsed.
This is the front line in Italy's battle against the coronavirus. A battle, doctors say, they're losing. This is one of Europe's most advanced hospitals on its knees.
Without a huge national effort to stop the spread of coronavirus, there will come a moment when no health service in the world could possibly cope.
So, protecting the NHS became the national priority, and we were to do our bit for it by staying at home. As of today, the NHS has survived its biggest ever challenge. But at what cost to patients, present and future, and at what cost to staff? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Before we can make sense of where the pandemic has left the NHS, we need to understand what state it was in before the pandemic arrived. Chris Cook is a journalist with Tortoise Media, and he specialises in public policy. What kind of capacity does the NHS usually operate at?
So if you go back 10, 15 years, people used to talk about an 85% occupancy standard. Just to unpack what that means, it basically means you should have about 15% of slack inside hospitals on, you know, a normal day. What's happened in the last few years is that the NHS has been running at over 95% capacity.
Some people would say, well, that's just because you were more efficient. It's better to operate. I mean, after all, if you're an airline, you want to operate at 95% loads. If you're a hospital, you should want 95% of your beds full.
So it's completely right that, like, people should aim to have hospitals running as hot as basically we can safely run them. As you say, that's what efficiency looks like. The problem we've got is really two big things. On the one hand, there is an unstoppable rising tide of demand for healthcare in this country. We're an aging country, we're a growing country, and also we're a country where medical advances mean that actually you can get more stuff treated. So if you look at, say, February 2011 and February 2020, if you like, the last month before the pandemic, over that 9 years, the number of people turning up at A&Es went from just over 1 million to 1.2 million. So over about 9 years, we've got a 17% increase in the number of people just turning up at the hospitals. And if you imagine that, you know, the system stays at the same size, that would mean that over those 9 years, hospitals would have to get 17% more efficient. And bluntly, that's just not possible.
So essentially, we've been very reluctant, for one reason or another, to build up the capacity so that if anything happened, we could cope with it, or indeed actually to cope with what we knew was going to happen.
I mean, that's right. And actually, the NHS was relatively protected under the coalition government and under the Tory government since from austerity. Relatively protected, right? It didn't go through what local government went through, but spending did not rise in line with demand for healthcare. And so we ended up squeezing and asset sweating the health service. If you look in the accounts for hospitals, in 2010, hospitals sat on around 7,500 hectares of land. They now sit on around 4,700 hectares. They've been selling off land to pay for, you know, keeping the show on the road.
What about staffing?
So one of the most important constraints on the NHS at the beginning of this crisis was about staff. Going into the crisis, there was a workforce shortage, if you look at persistent vacancies that couldn't be filled, of about 100,000. We knew there were too few nurses. We knew that we hadn't been training enough.
Let's just take a moment to look at the way in which the NHS operates in different parts of the United Kingdom, because we have devolved administrations.
So there are really important and distinct differences in the way that healthcare is organised in different countries. So, for example, in England, we've separated out public health responsibilities away from the NHS. That's gone to local government. GPs are sort of self-standing entities. The hospitals themselves have been encouraged to compete with one another and not to cooperate. And that's meant that the ability of English authorities to respond has probably been diminished compared to Scottish, Welsh, Northern Irish authorities in a crisis.
Okay, Chris, let's talk about money. What you've described is a situation whereby we have got more and more and more out of a system that hasn't actually, despite the money we've been putting into it, been growing sufficiently quickly. What set of Treasury policies and assumptions is that situation based on?
The Treasury exists as a cost control mechanism, right? So it likes to be able to see where money is going. One of the things it hates about the NHS is actually the NHS will take money for one thing and then doctors will decide to spend it on something else. And you know what? There's nothing you can do about it. You can't take the valve out of the heart after it's been put into it. There's an inability to, you know, recover spending that went to the wrong place. There's also a problem with the fact that demand is permanently rising. So however much money you put into the NHS, it will always find a use for it. There's also a problem with the fact that the NHS has its own, if you like, political power. So if we have a really bad winter and the NHS overspends, what are you going to do about it? You can't punish hospitals. You can't take money out of them for next year because, you know what, they'll need to spend it again next year, probably. And so there was a terrible analogy the Treasury officials have heard use, which is waterboarding, which is a, you know, the torture technique where you basically make someone feel like they're drowning. They needed, they felt, to make the NHS feel like there really wasn't going to be more money if they ran out. And that was the only way to make them actually respond and become more efficient. But part of the problem is that you genuinely have to force hospitals to become perhaps so efficient that they don't have any slack to cope with an emergency. In fact, it wasn't really able to cope with winter. When we talk about efficiency, what we really mean is we want to have the leanest possible hospital estate. We want to get people in and out as fast as possible and to have as little spare capacity on hand as possible. The thing is that that's obviously a disaster in a crisis because you can't surge up, you can't flex up. The ideal hospital for a lot of NHS managers was basically a place probably with one bed where you'd see, say, 1,000 patients in a day. They'd all sit down for, you know, a minute and a half and then be whisked off again. The problem, obviously, is that that is an incredibly vulnerable way of thinking about the NHS, because if something goes wrong with your one bed, you're stuffed.
Chris Cook. That's where the NHS was at the start of the year. But rather a lot has changed since then. I asked Rachel Schreyer, health reporter for the BBC, to give us a rundown on how the NHS has been affected in the last few months.
As the NHS was facing up to the prospect of coronavirus hitting the UK in early spring, everyone's minds were full of scenes from Europe, of patients crowded in corridors and doctors having to make terrible choices about who to treat. The major fear was that there wouldn't be enough beds, equipment and staff to care for all the coronavirus patients. And the NHS bosses were also worried that the virus could spread within hospitals. So everyone began to talk about putting the NHS on a war footing. They had to come up with a plan. First of all, to do that, Hospital Trust cleared a lot of beds by cancelling routine operations and also discharging elderly people back into care homes, which we now know added a whole other raft of problems. But at that time, from around mid-March, the biggest focus was on preventing the health service from being overwhelmed.
This is a message from the government. Coronavirus is a national emergency. Anyone can get it and anyone can spread it. Stay home.
GP services started happening mainly over the phone. And to make sure they had enough staff, former doctors and nurses and also final year students were invited to either return to the health service or join earlier than planned. And on top of that, staff were redeployed from other specialties that were less in demand to work with coronavirus patients. I spoke to one doctor who normally worked with chronic pain patients doing things like giving them cortisol injections and physical therapy, who was moved to the front line to work in an intensive care unit. From early on, hospitals began to be split into red and green zones, meaning those with coronavirus patients and those without. Then, to create even more space for the wave of cases they were expecting, the NHS began to plan for sites where any overflow of patients could be treated. The first Nightingale Hospital was opened in London at the beginning of April, followed by six others in England and other temporary field hospitals across the UK. And on the 21st of March, the NHS in England made a deal with the private sector to buy in another 8,000 beds, over 1,000 ventilators and 20,000 medical staff at cost price. Government essentially said it would write the NHS a blank cheque for whatever it needed, starting with £7 billion for things like beds and ventilators. All through the UK, routine operations like hip and knee replacements were delayed and cancer treatments were suspended. In Scotland, planned operations fell from 30,000 in April 2019 to just 3,000 this April, while in England they fell by 80% this May compared with last year. By the peak of infections in early April, 30,000 extra beds had been freed up within the NHS without the new hospitals being needed. So rather than an overflow, the busiest Nightingale Hospital in London had only seen just over 50 patients by the time it was stood down in early May. The Harrogate Nightingale Hospital in Yorkshire has so far never treated a coronavirus patient. This was mainly seen as an NHS success story, but a new fear began to emerge: that the message to the public to stay away had worked too well. As early as April, Health Secretary Matt Hancock began to talk about the NHS as being open for business.
If you are told to go to hospital, the place you need to be is in hospital.
In May, Public Health England even launched a campaign to try and get the message out, but people were still staying away. There were only half the normal number of visits to A&E in April, and planned treatments were still being delayed, as well as screening for cancer, heart problems and diabetes. The fact that lots of services were suspended meant big delays started to build up. In England, the proportion of people waiting more than 6 weeks for some key tests, including for cancer and heart disease, went from under 3% in February to over 50% by April. Starting around the beginning of May, the NHS began to open up lots of its non-COVID services to more people, including chemotherapy and heart ops. But it still faces one of the major problems that's been a concern from the start, which is preventing the spread of infection. And doing that means hospitals can only be about 60% as full as they were before, with demand for services higher than ever.
Rachel Schreier. This feels ominous. Dealing with the first wave of coronavirus has left the NHS depleted. The need for social distancing makes its operation more difficult. There are likely to be spikes in the pandemic before a vaccine is ready. And then there are all those non-COVID-related cases piling up. So what's the scale of the challenge the NHS now faces, and what can be done to help meet that challenge? Joining me in the briefing room are three of the UK's leading health policy experts. Dr. Jennifer Dixon is the Chief Executive of the Health Foundation and a former policy advisor to the head of the NHS. Professor Carol Proper is a health economist at Imperial College London and President of the Royal Society of Economics. And Nigel Edwards is Chief Executive of the Nuffield Trust, an independent health think tank.
The future's looking very challenging indeed. The logistical challenges of keeping patients socially distanced in waiting areas, of having one-way flows, of segregating the potentially infectious from the definitely infectious and the non-infectious, the preparation required to do tests and the cleaning afterwards all present a huge productivity challenge, which means it's going to be extremely difficult for the NHS to get back to anything like even 80% of its previous productive capacity. Staff have to use enhanced personal protective equipment, which takes time to put on and off, of course. And then because of the nature of the infection, you need to clean the equipment, a CT scanner, for example, very much more intensively than you would normally do between patients. And then there are some procedures like dentistry or endoscopy, putting a scope into people's esophagus, which generates huge amounts of aerosol, which is known to be a high infection hazard.
So where previously, let's say, you had 10 staff did 5 procedures during an afternoon, what you're saying is you might now need 15 staff to do 3 procedures in an afternoon.
Well, indeed. And of course, you may also need an additional operating theatre. One of the questions that's current is how long do you need to leave an operating theatre if you've operated on someone who you think might have been infectious?
We have a picture there of how more difficult it is just to do the things that we were doing before in the hospital sector. What is the position we have reached with the GPs?
The position is a little bit more positive. The GPs have been very inventive and have adopted telephone and, to some extent, video consultation for a lot of their patients, which has meant that they can continue to offer service perhaps in a safer, although not necessarily a quicker way. There's been an assumption that video and telephone is quicker. It isn't necessarily. But at some point, you do still need to see patients, and then they will have the same challenges that hospitals and outpatient departments have, which is segregating patients, running very strict appointments, times, and of course having to use personal protective equipment where they're doing physical examination or getting up close to the patient. It may also make GPs slightly more cautious in that they may order more tests or be more ready to prescribe antibiotics if they can't physically examine the patient.
Jennifer Dixon, let's dig down into this, into the question of what has backed up things that haven't been done.
Well, I think we can quantify the number of people who haven't come forward who would have been referred, for example, for cancer, the number of elective surgeries that have stopped completely, for example, and also not forgetting the follow-on effects of COVID in many thousands of people. Yeah. So there's quite a lot of a backlog, and that's even absent a second spike. But I think one of the big issues at the moment is the NHS's approach to risk here. For example, I was talking to a chief executive of a large London teaching trust, and they're still largely, well, I wouldn't say shut down, but largely not dealing with a lot of non-COVID patients, and yet they have only 3 admissions for COVID. So the question is how the NHS can dial up and approach risk in a way that the government's looking at regional differences in lockdown.
And that is, I have to say, a story that I've also heard anecdotally, which is that you do have hospitals that don't have very many people in them that claim to be open for business in some kind of way that's normal, but actually very little that's normal is happening.
Exactly right. And I think the question here then is how much local decision making can the NHS tolerate? And I think that's something that we still have to work out, because as we saw in Leicester, some parts of the country will have flare-ups and others won't. We're still left with the issue of public fear, which we haven't talked about. So there are challenges on the NHS supplying services, just as Nigel has been pointing out. But then there's also the huge fear. 50% of people on a poll that we just did said that they were very uncomfortable to turn up to hospital because they're worried about getting COVID. And then a few percentage more were worried about overburdening the NHS.
This feels to me like a slightly disastrous situation, really, because every day that goes past, yet more suppressed demand is effectively being created to add to that you've already got. And in that case, this is just growing and growing and growing as we speak.
That's absolutely right. And we will see that in the data that follow on mortality and morbidity, unless we can somehow dial up services more fully, which I know that, you know, clearly the NHS wants to try to do. But we will be facing, particularly with cancer, chronic disease management, neurological conditions, as well as the deterioration of people who would normally have hip and knee replacements and things like that, that are going to cause very real damage. So I think this is where this risk calculation really has to be much more sophisticated than we we've had to do to date.
Okay, so bluntly, we need to probably take more risk. Carol Proper, who is being most affected by what is happening?
We know that if you look at normal routine operations, electives, things like hips, knees, cataracts, tests, they're heavily concentrated amongst the over 50s. And there's a very steep age gradient. So, you know, more 60-year-olds, more 70-year-olds, rising to about 80. And indeed, the same people who are affected by COVID. It's clear that whilst elective treatment doesn't necessarily rise by deprivation, emergency treatment, which is treatment that a lot of people have not sought for the kind of fear reasons or has been shut down because of PPE reasons and limited, we can see there that people who live in deprived areas use emergency services much more than people who do not live in deprived areas. Right. But this is not like a winter flu epidemic that just slows things down. We've also got a major recession. And we know that recessions have a knock-on effect on poor health. They hit the young, they hit those who have mental illnesses, and they often hit people who live in deprived areas. So that, again, I think that inequalities are going to rise unless we can address these very clearly.
Right. Nigel Edwards, just in case we haven't been quite gloomy enough, there's also the elephant in the care home, social care. What have we learned about the relations of social care with the NHS that possibly we didn't quite understand before? Because I have to say, from the outside, it looks like a disaster.
In some parts of the NHS, I think the NHS has done extremely well in providing support and training to care homes, sending staff in there, providing support by video and telephone. But unfortunately, this is quite a patchy picture, and one hears that in quite a few places, as existed before the pandemic, the level of support and help that social care and care homes has received has perhaps not been adequate given their very fragile state.
The NHS clearly needs enhanced capacity. I imagine that means staff as well as facilities to be able to see and treat people to get back even remotely to the previous situation in this new environment, let alone go forwards. Carol Proper, does the NHS currently have the staff it needs to get us through that backlog?
The plain answer to that is no. We go into this with a backdrop of a shortage of staff, and I think we are going to see more shortages. Partly, I think many consultants, many clinicians have felt that they've worked and have worked incredibly hard during this period, but many have felt unsupported. I think we're going to see a wave of early retirement by some senior consultants. We're still left with a nursing shortage, and we know that that nursing shortage is particularly bad in areas where the national wage for nurses is rather low relative to the cost of living.
You mean places like London?
Maybe less London, where there are the prestigious teaching hospitals, but more the areas around London, the southeast, where costs of living are very similar to London, and the hospitals perhaps don't have the prestige that people want to go and work in them.
So, Carol, what would we have to do to reverse that?
This is difficult, but we're going to have to pay nurses more. At the moment, the idea is that if you work in Newquay or you work in Newham, you get the same for the same grade with a little bit extra for London waiting. I think we're going to have to look very hard at that national form of wage regulation and think about moving to a more local, regional level.
Which is never popular with unions. Never.
It's never popular with unions. And I think it brings us on to something Jennifer's talked about, which is this trade-off between a national NHS and national policy and an NHS which actually serves very different local needs and operates in very different local labour markets.
The quickest way to get qualified nurses in is, frankly, to import them.
It is, but that's a problem because I don't think from abroad Britain has been seen as dealing very well with the COVID problem, particularly in comparison to some of our European competitors. So we operate in an international nursing labour market, and we're facing a worldwide nursing shortage.
Now, Jennifer Dixon, that's the personnel side of it. What about the facilities, the buildings, the equipment?
Well, clearly the NHS needs to have maintained funding levels and enhance them to cope with this. So money is important there for revenue. Capital spending is also needed. We know, as we've seen, that we are underbedded, we're underventilated, we have fewer doctors and nurses. So on the capital side, definitely that needs to be boosted. So that's another area where I think, as well as the workforce, that the NHS needs to have a solution. Social care, we've talked about, that's a big running sore, decades of neglect from governments who've kicked the can down the road. And then there's a whole set of other things to do with learning from how the NHS has impressively shifted care across sectors and how the public have been using virtual. So how that can be supported in future to increase productivity using technology, but also using staff in a different way.
Nigel Edwards.
It's been well known, but not really gripped, that a large proportion of hospital beds are occupied by people who could be cared for in other settings. And actually, the big investment that would probably make a big difference going forward, rather than more acute hospital beds, is more rehabilitation, home care, and care for people who need support at home or temporary support in a nursing home or community hospital.
Can I just stop you there?
Yeah, sorry.
I was just wondering, what would that mean you had to do practically in order to boost rehabilitation and home care?
To boost rehabilitation and home care probably requires a fairly significant investment in nurses, but actually you can supplement that with properly trained care assistants and other staff, support to carers via technology, and physiotherapy and other therapy disciplines, where fortunately it's one of the few areas where we do have something of oversupply. And one of the things that's really come out of this is where we've had very high quality local decision making and regional decision making, we've tended to get better and more agile results than when the Department of Health has tried to organise things like testing and tracing. I've long suspected that 55 million people is too big a unit to try and manage a healthcare system.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because the 55 million you're talking about, that's England. And of course, we have the devolved systems in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So are we saying that actually we think there has been an enhanced performance in those places, partly because they have been more local and they have been able to be more responsive to their situation?
Scotland certainly seems to be of a size which, if you look across Europe, it's the size of health systems that seem to be able to respond agilely and effectively, thinking long-term and to crises. Northern Ireland and Wales have other issues about the nature of the populations they serve and issues of history which make it slightly more difficult for them. But I think we have seen where we've had the sort of the regional bits of the NHS springing into action, on the whole, they've done pretty effectively, and that they're again of the same sorts of size as Scotland.
Carol Proper, how optimistic are you that we will actually have learned the lessons that are necessary and will actually have the will to implement what needs to be done?
I think this pandemic has really laid clear that the centralisation tendency of central government does not always work, and that things are done at the wrong level. For example, PPE is being done at local level, whereas track, trace and test has been done at national level, where it should be done at local level. I'm quite optimistic, because I think a number of people are looking forward and thinking about how we should evolve post-COVID to take a new look at our healthcare system.
What about you, Nigel?
I'm moderately optimistic. Some of our history doesn't suggest that the system is quite as good as learning as it should be, partly because of the very heavy level of political involvement always makes it very difficult to admit that things could have been better, and a big tendency to draw a line under things and move on. So moderately optimistic only, I'm afraid.
Okay, quite optimistic, moderately optimistic. Jennifer Dixon, where are you on the scale?
I am optimistic, actually. What has been stunning is how fast this national organisation has moved in a short period of time. And everyone tells you that decision making has taken days and hours, not years. So I think whatever is planned for, you know, the hard rein on the civil service, whatever is planned for the rest of the public sector, I'm hoping that government will look at the lessons and realise that actually, if you trust professionals, if you trust managerial competence, they will deliver.
Dr. Jennifer Dixon there with Professor Carol Proper and Nigel Edwards. My thanks also to Chris Cook and Rachel Schreier. And my conclusion, which surprises me really, the scale of what the NHS faces is daunting and the resources it needs are enormous. But we have learned really valuable lessons, not least the need for devolution in the service. So maybe we can emerge from this enhanced. Maybe. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Beth Sager-Fenton, Kirsty Knight and Joe Kent, mixed by Never Missirian and edited by Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on coronavirus and the care sector, the psychological impact of the pandemic, or for something different, on what drives religious intolerance. You can find them all and much more on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.